Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast. This is your host, E. Marcel Fortut. Hope everyone's had a good day out there today. A little bit of a change for us today, recording an edition of the podcast during the morning. So the tea is definitely being used and definitely going to be available all throughout the show. So good weekend for me overall. A lot of sports going on, and we're going to hit up a lot of topics today. And we're going to talk about the NCAA men's basketball regionals that took place and preparations for the Final Four are in full swing down here in Atlanta. So I'm going to actually do my predictions for the games on my next podcast on Wednesday, but we're going to review what happened this past weekend. Opening day was yesterday as well, so going to review some things that happened on the first day of the Major League Baseball season. Going to talk about the NBA as well, heading towards the playoff push. Playoffs actually start in a few weeks. So going to hit some notes there and other miscellaneous information and news and notes from the world of sports. So sit back, enjoy the show here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. So, of course, this past weekend was dominated by the NCAA men's basketball tournament and all the events that took place there. I'm going to review just each region and my thoughts on what happened there and maybe tease some of my predictions for the Final Four. So, in the East region, biggest story from that was the reemergence of Syracuse. During the middle part of the year, Syracuse was a top five, top ten team, and it looked like they'd make that big run to the Final Four. However, they had some stumbling moments, and I thought that their lowest moment was the end of the regular season when they scored only 39 points in a loss at Georgetown, ironically at the same location where the East region took place this past weekend. So Syracuse, I thought, was the big winner from that entire weekend. But first, we'll get to Syracuse's win over Indiana. And that's where I think you really saw the 2-3 zone emerge as the premier defensive setup in all of college basketball today. And it's kind of odd. It's interesting you see the ebbs and flows of college basketball. Back in the 70s and 80s, you saw a lot of zone play. You know, that was the preeminent defense that you would see for a lot of good teams. However, you start seeing in the 90s, especially with teams like UNLV and Arkansas, a lot of pressure defense and a lot of pressing. And you still see teams like VCU currently use that style of play as far as a lot of pressure, man-to-man defense, a lot of aggressiveness on that front. But I think Syracuse has reverted back to a style where Jim Boeheim's always had been known for using the zone primarily, but he would use man-to-man principles as well at times. But I guess a few years ago, he decided to just strictly use the zone. And the good part about the zone defense, and you saw it in the Indiana win, and especially over the victory over Marquette in the Elite Eight, is the lack of preparation that is required to use the 2-3 zone. And that's not it's not an insult on the actual players themselves who are talented. I mean, you have Michael Carter Williams, you have James Southland, you have some elite players on Syracuse. However, when you use a 2-3 zone, and I know playing personally, when I was on the basketball court doing my thing, when you have a zone defense, you don't cover an individual man, you cover your own area. So it doesn't matter if you have a guy who's 5'11" or 6'10", you know, you cover that same area, and it actually requires physically a little bit less effort. I mean, there are a lot of principles that are needed for the zone, especially when you trap in the corners or when you get the offensive player at the high post, which Marquette tried to take advantage of and really struggled with. But I think the advantage of playing the zone is that you don't have to focus so much on defense and the individual scouting reports of the players, and you can focus more on your offensive side of things. And then furthermore, on the other end, you make your opponent focus so much on using their offensive principles and applying it to. And I think you saw it a lot in the Indiana game, where Cody Zeller, outstanding player, he was more concerned with trying to get to that high post and use the passes from that area and everything like that, instead of just flowing with the offense that Indiana normally runs and getting Oladipo involved and Yogi Ferrell and all those guys. Instead, they were so focused on, we have to get that pass into the high post, and we have to do this, we have to do that. And I really think that affected the offensive flow of Indiana tremendously, and that caused a loss there. Disappointing year for Indiana, I think. I mean, preseason number one, has Cody Zeller. Victor Oladipo emerged himself as an All-America player as well. I mean, for Indiana to truly return to their solid high standards, they had to make a trip to Atlanta this year. They had to make it to a Final Four. Now, the unfortunate part for them is that they're going to probably lose their entire starting lineup, either to graduation or to the NBA. So Tom Crean has a lot of work to do as far as getting his squad back together. But, I mean, a solid year for Indiana and everything. Won the conference title, Big Ten, but that was a bad loss for them. And then a team that I think overachieved throughout the year, met the reality, is the Miami Hurricanes, when Marquette really took it to them as well. Previewing that contest, and when we had Spencer here a week ago, I thought the biggest thing with that contest would be a contrast in styles. You have Marquette, who's very deliberate and likes to run the clock, and we saw that a lot in the Syracuse game. And I thought that that'd be a big contrast to Miami, and moving, who likes to go up and down the court with Shane Larkin and their athletes. But in the end, you saw that Marquette's defense was enough to hold off Miami. And that was a really good year for Miami. Unlike Indiana, who I thought had a really disappointing year. And it's hard to say a disappointing year when you make a Sweet 16 and win your conference title. But Indiana's standards are very high, or expectations were high. Miami, I expected them to finish maybe fourth or fifth in the ACC, but to win their outright conference title in the regular season and win the conference tournament, as well as make it to a Sweet 16, that was a good run for Miami. And Jim Larrañaga deserves a lot of credit for that. But then going to the regional final, well, Syracuse, once again, that zone really plotted Marquette down offensively. And Marquette actually only scored 39 points in that loss. So, good win for Syracuse. Jim Boeheim, first coach to make it to the Final Four in four different decades. Like the 90s, the 80s, the 90s, the Ophirs, or 2000, and the 2010s. So, outstanding career for him last year for Syracuse, and heading to the ACC with a Final Four appearance. So good win there. In the West region, definitely the surprise as far as all of the teams making it to the Final Four down here in Atlanta, Wichita State, whom I thought handled LaSalle pretty easily. I expected that. LaSalle, 13 seed, made a nice run. I represented Philadelphia proud, but you saw that contest coming. Wichita State's aggressive defense and athletes, you saw that loss happening. Ohio State, an entertaining win over Arizona. Arizona, I think, actually finally played to their potential towards the later part of the season and in this tournament. They got that big win over Belmont and Wisconsin in the earlier rounds, and took Ohio State to the end. And Ohio State was kind of on borrowed time anyway. And you saw that with Wichita State. Ohio State took a late three-pointer by Aaron Kraft to beat Iowa State. And it took a lot of late heroics to get past Arizona. But Ohio State got past the Wildcats. But Wichita State kind of beat Ohio State in their own game as far as using that Big Ten sturdy defense plotting style of play. They just did it better than Ohio State did. So Greg Marshall, who, if you're one of my Charleston friends out there. We remembered when he accepted a job at College of Charleston for a few days and then left to return to Winthrop. And he did a really good job over there in Rock Hill and has done an outstanding job at Wichita State as well. So it's their first Final Four, I believe, since the 1950s. That's a really big win for Wichita State there. South region, probably the most entertaining region as far as the games themselves. Florida got a victory over Florida Gulf Coast, and we're going to talk about Andy Enfield in a little bit, the Florida Gulf Coast coach. So Dunk City really met their fate. Florida took, and it was funny because I actually watched the first part of this game, a lot of the first half, and kind of faded out towards the second. You saw Florida Gulf Coast get some moments there. They got some lob dunks, hit some three-pointers, and you thought that maybe they can continue this run that they've been on the past few weeks. But Florida really clamped down on the defensive end and used their physicality. I think that's, and when you have some of these teams, they finally realized, especially with Florida, it's like, we're just bigger than this other team. And while Florida has the good guard play, with Rosario and with Boykin, I think they realized, all right, we actually have some bigger players than Florida Gulf Coast, so we're going to pound it inside. And that's what you saw there. So, outstanding run for the Florida Gulf Coast Eagles. All of us Atlantic Sun fans here in Atlanta were happy to see them make that outstanding run. Probably the game of the weekend, I think, was the Michigan victory over Kansas. And we've talked about Indiana having a disappointing season with making it only to the round of 16. Kansas really should be kicking themselves as well. That was a really disappointing loss. Now, as far as Michigan, we'll get to Michigan when I analyze the Michigan-Florida game. But sticking with Kansas, that's another team that you saw Ben McLemore, and you saw some other guys on that squad with Whitney. That's a team that should be down here in Atlanta as well, along with Indiana. And they had a double-digit lead in that contest against Michigan all the way to a few minutes left in the game until Trey Burke really took over, hit some long three-pointers, including probably about a 25, 27-footer to get the game into overtime, or actually to get the victory for Michigan. And once again, that's another loss by Bill Self in a round that they really shouldn't have had a loss in. So interesting times for Kansas. They're going to lose a lot of players as well, similar to Indiana. But they just ran into a Michigan team that refused to lose. And speaking of the Wolverines, excellent win over Florida. Thing about Michigan, I was skeptical when I did my preseason Final Fours. I think my when I did it, I was like, who are the four best teams? I had Indiana winning the national title. Obviously, that didn't happen. But I thought the four best teams coming into the season were Indiana, Louisville, Kansas, and Michigan. Those are the four teams that I thought coming into the year were going to be the elite-level squads. And obviously, we've seen what Louisville's done. We'll get to the Midwest region in a moment. But Michigan, I thought with Trey Burke and Hardaway Jr. and Glenn Robinson III and the other role players, that they would have enough to make a run to Atlanta. They had some up and downs throughout the season, but they finally got it together. And that, once again, Trey Burke, who I said in my last podcast, I thought we'd have a run like Mike Conley Jr. did back in, I think, 2007 with Ohio State, when Greg Oden was getting a lot of the attention with Ohio State, and they made a run to the Final Four or the championship game, and ended up losing to Florida. I thought that, and Conley ended up being a top five pick with the Memphis Grizzlies. I thought Trey Burke would kind of have a similar run as well, as far as you're seeing a point guard really take over during an NCAA tournament and lead his team to a long run. So Michigan getting that win was very good for them as well. And we'll get to the final region, the Midwest. Obviously, coming into this weekend, that's probably the region with the biggest heavyweights as far as national prestige. Louisville took care of Oregon pretty easily in that contest. And good run for Oregon. They were underseeded as a 12, but still had some good wins in the Pac-12 and made it to the Sweet 16. Duke won over Michigan State. I really thought Michigan State would get that victory. I thought the physicality of Michigan State getting offensive rebounds and defensive rebounds as well would be too much for Duke. But the Blue Devils found a way to get past that. And obviously the Louisville-Duke game, final game of on Sunday. We'll get to the Kevin Ware injury, the broken leg, and the reaction to that when I get to my ruffling my feathers section. But just sticking strictly to the game itself, a good effort by Louisville, obviously winning that contest. First half went back and forth. Obviously, the big Ware injury took a lot of energy from them. They were able to keep it together for the rest of the first half. My feeling was when I saw the injury that if they could keep it together, keep it within a few points, and just get to the locker room where they're not in the spotlight of the cameras, they could take a deep breath, kind of assess the situation, and they'll be able to get it together and, you know, and move on. Obviously, the guard play with Russ Smith and Silva has been carrying the Cardinals throughout the entire postseason, and they continued their dominance against Duke, who once again shot too many three-pointers, didn't make enough jumpers. And that's been the story of Duke the past few seasons, where I don't know if it's a lack of big men not wanting to go to Duke. And Mason Plumlee had a very good year himself. But it seems like in the past 5 or 6 years, you've really seen Duke embrace a small ball, you know, era and shoot a lot of three-pointers and a lot of dribble penetrations and spreading the floor out. And it's not like Duke has ever had, like, elite post players, like that seven-footer who does. I think the last big post guy they had was probably Cherokee Parks. Yes, Elton Brand, and they've had a few others as far as post guys that do you know, moves on the block. But they've never really had, like, that big seven-footer that's been a big shot blocker. I guess that's just not their style. And I think the problem is when you play in that way, you really struggle when you face good defenses and teams that can actually get some boards. And that's what you have Louisville as well. They have some good shot blockers, good rebounders, and I thought that hurt them in the end. So our Final Four is set. We're going to have Syracuse, Wichita State, Michigan, and Louisville. And once again, so the next podcast we'll have a preview of those games individually. But that's my recap of the weekend as far as the NCAA tournament. Some coaching news. We'll get to some of these coaches right now. Steve Alford was announced moving from New Mexico to UCLA. Interesting. We had a conversation a few podcasts ago about the expectations of UCLA and the realities of it. I didn't see the Shaka Smarts and the Brad Stevens move happening as far as UCLA goes. And we've talked about, you know, Shaka Smart and Smart and Stevens and their situations at Butler and VCU respectively. They don't have to head to a major conference to have an impact on a national level. We're looking at Greg Marshall right now at Wichita State, and we saw Florida Gulf Coast make a run. And you don't really have to be at the elite programs to make a run. I think you have to be at an elite program to maybe be more consistent just with the resources and your setup and your recruiting base. But overall, if you're making X amount of dollars, and these are all seven-figure guys, it's not like how in football, so you've really seen this. We talk about you see a lot more of the mid-major struggle as far as competing on a national level. Basketball, all you need are six or seven players that fit your system and the belief, and you can make a run. So Steve Alford heading to UCLA, I thought was a good move for them. I know that they've had some disappointments as far as when he was at New Mexico, losing multiple times to double-digit seeds in the NCAA tournament. But I thought that if you were going to get rid of Ben Howland, who I thought on the court didn't deserve the firing, but if you read the off-the-court stuff, I thought that the relationship was strained between UCLA and Howland. Steve Alford's not the worst choice. He's done well at New Mexico. He has a West Coast base. And the biggest thing for that job is they're really going to have to recruit Southern California hard and get more players from that area. And similar to when you look at college football with Alabama, Georgia, Florida, USC, Texas, even Ohio State, you have to recruit your state and your area well. And if you recruit from that area, from the states of Florida and Tennessee sometimes, but Georgia and Alabama, things like that, you'll do well in football, similar to basketball. If you recruit Southern California and really the entire state, or the West Coast, if you dip into Arizona and maybe Oregon and even the state of Washington, you'll be very successful. And UCLA is still an elite program. I mean, I know the John Wooden days are a long time ago, but it's still UCLA, and they have a chance to do a lot better, I think, than they have been. And Steve Alford has a proven track record. He has some success at New Mexico, and he's done well in his other positions as well. So we'll see how that goes. Tubby Smith to Texas Tech. That's really a odd choice. I think if you're Texas Tech, for Tubby Smith, I thought he was unfairly fired from Minnesota. Obviously, we don't know all the ins and outs of the relationship and what was going on there, but I didn't think that was the right firing for Minnesota, who expectations, I think, are a little bit higher than warranted. But I think if you're a school like Texas Tech, I would have taken a chance on a younger coach, a coach that brings some energy and can bring some youthfulness and something different to the program. But we know what Tubby's going to produce within the Big 12. He is going to probably win around 17 to 19 games per season. They're going to be a perennial bubble team and make the tournament every 2 or 3 years. Which, if for Texas Tech, I think is not the worst expectations. But as far as if you're Texas Tech, I think you need a younger guy. They've had Cliff Clinsbury now, moving with the football team, gone with a guy in his 30s, prolific offensive mind. They lack a lot of energy. With Tubby Smith, you're going to get solid defense and some decent offense. And I just think if you're one of those schools, you need to take a chance. And I don't have a list of guys that they could have hired, you know, particularly, but I would have gone a different direction than Tubby Smith. And then finally, Andy Enfield to USC, going to Southern California. Be very careful, USC Trojans, with this. I know Andy Enfield has a solid reputation in NBA. He used to be an assistant in Boston under Rick Pitino. And we all know the backstory of Enfield. But seeing Florida Gulf Coast up close and personal here at working with Kennesaw State, it's a team that didn't even win the conference this year. And they had an excellent run, got everyone excited. And trust me, I said, as an Atlantic Sun fan and someone that works with the Atlantic Sun in, you know, different capacities, I was very happy to see them represent the conference well. But you got to be careful with two wins over Georgetown and San Diego State being enough to lead a program with a decent situation in the Pac-12. It's a major jump for him. And God bless him, it's a good move. He's going to make a lot more money, be in a really good area of Southern California. But I'm not too sure about that move as well. And I said, you got to be careful when you get these mid-major coaches and elevate them. For every successful situation that you can think of, there's always the ones like the Dan Monson and Gonzaga back in 1999 when they made the Elite Eight and eventually lost to Florida in that contest. They made that run and he was hired by Minnesota and that was a disaster. Stan Heath is my prime example. Back in 2001, led Kent State to the Elite Eight. His first year of coaching there, and Arkansas took him, and he was not very good in Arkansas. And a similar situation to Florida Gulf Coast and Kent State. So you have to be very careful when you get these mid-major guys and just give them the keys to your franchise or to your college program after one or two good games. And I said, I think he's a very good coach. He's going to get some athletes there at USC. But it's just interesting to see the state of Southern California athletics on the basketball front with the new coaches, Steve Alford and Andy Enfield, with UCLA and USC. So those are my thoughts on the NCAA basketball tournament and the coaching carousel that took place so far. As I said, next show we're going to preview the individual matchups of the Final Four and everything like that. We take a break here in the Sports Inquirer podcast. And when I come back, we're going to talk about the opening day of Major League Baseball here on the Sports Inquirer Network. It's always fun this time of year when you get to early April, meaning that it's time for the Major League Baseball season to kick off and get started. And the greatest part about opening day, in my opinion, is the overreactions on every level. I've been on both ends of it with the New York Mets, where they'll win the first game, you get a good start from your ace, get some good bullpen efforts. Those hitters look good, and you're like, man, we're going to make it to the World Series. We're going to win a division and do really well. And they end up finishing below 500 in middle of the pack. And then you have the other side of it where they look terrible the first year or the first game. And you're like, man, it's going to be a terrible year. We're not going to do really well at all. And then they end up putting together something decent. And every one of you out there listening and your respective baseball teams, we've all been there. So interesting opening day, though. As far as what happened, just some points from it. I didn't pick him to win the MVP, but Bryce Harper is going to have a monster year with the Nationals. He had two solo home runs in the Nationals 2-0 victory over Miami yesterday. That team is, if there's a team that's going to win 100 games, at least on the National League side, and have one of those potential special seasons like that, it's going to be the Nationals, and it was a perfect game for them. We could use a little bit more offense besides Harper's two home runs. But, you know, back to him, I was, you know, the thing about him is when you have a player reach the status that he has in such an early stage, he's not a teenager anymore technically, but, I mean, when you're 19 or 20 years old, I mean, that's still a young age. The pressure that he's under in Washington, as far as them needing an elite player and World Series expectations, it's not enough anymore just to win a division for them. If he's not gonna hit two home runs every game, obviously, but if he keeps a solid approach and between his Gold Glove potential on defense and his aggressiveness on the base pads, we're definitely looking at potential 40-40 season from him. And if he produces that at his age, he's going to have the best 2 years ever for a player. And I know the Mike Trout fans are out there as well. But him hitting the two home runs on opening day is outstanding. And then on the pitching front, you get Steven Strasburg pitching 7 innings of shutout ball. Rafael Soriano got the save. If you're a Nationals fan, that's exactly what you want to see from your entire roster. And the scary part about them is you dealt with Strasburg, and that was good. Now you got to deal with Gio Gonzalez and Zimmerman. So the Nationals are loaded. I mean, I predicted them to win the East and win the National League. As a matter of fact, I picked them to win the World Series. So I'm high on the Nationals. But even I didn't expect to see two home runs from Harper the first day in Strasburg to start off with 7 innings of shutout ball. On the other side of things, the Yankees are in trouble. I actually saw a decent amount of their 8-2 loss against Boston at home. They have some struggles that they're going to have to deal with. The thing about the Yankees, and I've seen predictions on all sides, I predicted them to finish next to last in the division. I picked the Red Sox to finish last. So the two lowest teams in my predictions for the AL East are the Yankees and Boston, which I don't even know the last time that happened. But the problems with the Yankees, it's on many levels. And you kind of saw it yesterday. Yes, I know that they have the injuries to their starting lineup with Alex Rodriguez and Mark Teixeira and Derek Jeter not being out there, and Curtis Granderson as well. The problem is that for a roster with all of that payroll, their bench is not very good as far as a team. And even when those players return, all the players I just mentioned that are out, you're going to see regression from each one of them. They're older players on the wrong side of 30. You know, so they're going to have some struggles. And when you can't get a victory from Sabathia, who is the only starter that I trust on that rotation. And I know people talk about Nova and Panera and even Andy Pettit. All of those guys I don't trust over the long term, either because of inconsistency or age with Pettit. Sabathia struggled, gave up 4 runs over the five innings in that loss. If they can't get those victories, they're going to struggle getting wins everywhere else. So that was just a bad look for the Yankees. Red Sox fans, and I could see them thinking, oh man, we might actually sneak into the playoffs. This is exciting. Hold the horses on that. The one thing I did like was the return to form by John Lester. He shut down the Yankees with 7 strikeouts over 5 hits, and he went 5 innings, you know, as you know, in the contest. I think with the return of his pitching coach, former pitching coach, being the manager of the Red Sox, and did a really good job of breaking down his mechanics. I think it was Rick Sutcliffe who broke down, his motion during the game, and how he looked back in, I think, 2010 and 11 as far as his throwing motion. And then in 2012, I guess he had to break down his mechanics. The reality is he has his old pitching coach when he has most success. And I think with that, you're going to see a comfort level with him. He has the potential, if he's not injured, to be a 20-game winner. I don't know if that offense and the team is going to allow him to get the 20 wins, but I think you should see a nice back season for him. The Mets, they did win 11-2 over San Diego. Got over the negative momentum of Johan Santana being out for the season with another shoulder injury and surgery. As I said, the Mets are not going to, they're still going to finish low in the league this year, in the National League, and not do well. But it's always good to see your team win an opening day contest. Now, a team that I got it right on all fronts were the Dodgers yesterday from the very beginning. Classy move letting Sandy Koufax throw out the first pitch. And for those of you out there who aren't too familiar with the with Sandy Koufax and his relationship to the Dodgers organization, they're the best pitcher that's ever pitched for the Dodgers all time, back when they were Brooklyn, and even and he had his prime in Los Angeles. And I don't know if it was Sandy Koufax himself being reclusive, or you hear stories about the ownership of the Dodgers not treating him well or not showing him respect. But you know what all that can mean. Point being is that there was a very strained relationship between the Dodgers and Sandy Koufax. And no matter what league you're in or what sport, it's tough when you have a strained relationship with the best player that ever pitched for your organization. So with the new Dodger ownership, they've really made amends as far as reaching out to Koufax, and it looks like he's responded in a positive way. And similar to Tommy Lasorda's role as far as being a special advisor to the management of the Dodgers, Sandy Koufax is now in that position as well. And he was down at spring training with the Dodgers, I believe, earlier this month or last month with the organization helping the pitchers out. And I thought it was a really good move having Magic Johnson look like he was going to throw out the first pitch, but Don Mattingly went to the bullpen for the lefty, and sure enough, it was Sandy Koufax. I thought it was a really classy move by the ownership of the Dodgers. And as a New Yorker, you hear so many stories about Sandy Koufax and the legacy and my friends with Dodger fans and what he means to the fans there. So I thought that was a really classy move having him throw out the first pitch. And then Clayton Kershaw, who's probably going to be, as I said, I was joking on Twitter yesterday, he's going to win 25 games. Harper's going to hit, you know, 60 home runs and all this other stuff. But he actually legitimately, he's not going to get to 25 wins. That's not happening in this day and era. But if he can, he's not pitch complete game shutouts and hit a home run in every contest as well. But if the Dodgers have the potential to, if they have aspirations to make the postseason, not having him as a wild card team, you have to be very pleased to see him throw a shutout against your main rival in the division in the Giants. So that was a really good moment for the Dodgers. So those are my Major League Baseball opening day thoughts here in the Sports Inquirer podcast. And once again, if you want to speak with me or send me information or shoot me an email, you can always send me an email to sportsinquirer@gmail.com. Also, we are on Twitter, as always, Sports Inquirer. And that's on Twitter, just, you know, on there. Facebook, on Sports Inquirer. And finally, on iTunes, you can subscribe to my show under the Sports Inquirer. So every time I put one of these new bad boys up and upload it, you will get an automatic upload and update on your iTunes system. So we're going to take another break here, and when I come back, we're going to get to some NBA thoughts here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. Interesting past week for the Miami Heat, the best team in the NBA. I believe this time last week, they actually suffered their first loss in 28 games with that loss to the Chicago Bulls. And we talked about, you know, the energy of the Bulls and what they showed in getting that victory over the Heat. I knew when that losing, when that winning streak ended and they lost their first game, that you're going to start seeing Miami start resting players. And that's a sensible option. And you see all the top teams do it. You see when the Celtics were at their zenith or their peak with their big three, you'd see Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, and Ray Allen take moments. The Spurs are the leaders of this, where you see the Manu Ginobili, Tim Duncan, and Tony Parker sit out for various moments throughout the season. And you kind of saw Miami Heat pull this move, where this past Sunday, in their victory over San Antonio on the road, you saw LeBron James and Dwayne Wade sit out the game, and Mario Chalmers as well. So that really left it to Chris Bosh to lead the offense. He did an outstanding job in getting the game winner for the Miami Heat. So while the Heat, we know, are the best team in the league, it's going to be interesting to see how they approach the rest of the regular season, because I think all of their individual goals are set. LeBron James is going to be the MVP for the fourth time in his career. The Heat are going to have the number one overall seed in the East. And we'll get to the NBA standings. As a matter of fact, let me just do a quick glance here. They have a four-game lead in the loss column over the San Antonio Spurs for home court advantage throughout the entire playoffs. And that's something you will want as well. So they're going to be playing for that as well. But you're going to start seeing some of the Heat players take some breaks, and it's well-deserved for them. As far as the other interesting tidbits, Knicks are on an 8-game winning streak. Interesting how they're now on a big winning streak without the services of Amari Stoudemire, who is out with another knee injury. Interesting thing about watching the Knicks up close, as I do, you would think with Amari Stoudemire, who, when healthy, and he actually was a solid contributor off the bench, very efficient when he came back from his previous knee injury this year, you would think the Knicks would be better as a team. But it's just an odd mix when they have Carmelo Anthony starting at the power forward position, along with Tyson Chandler. The Knicks run a lot more. They get a lot more three-point attempts. They seem to be more efficient offensively. And I don't know. And it's not a Stoudemire issue. But I guess it's a Stoudemire issue on the court. A lot of people seem to like him off the court. But when you have, they have some impressive wins over Boston and Memphis during this eight-game winning streak. They have a big game against Miami tonight on the road. And that's going to be a good indication of kind of where they are as a team heading into the playoffs. And they also face Atlanta tomorrow night here in town. So that's going to be really interesting to see how the Knicks do over the next few games. And just looking at the standings overall, I'm looking at the East. And as far as battles going on, the Heat, I said, obviously are going to be the number one seed overall. Interesting battle, though, for the two through four slots. As far as the Pacers, right now, they're in the number two seed, but the Knicks are right there. They're technically tied with them for that two or three seed. Interesting thing about that one is that you're going to want to avoid facing Boston in the first round. And currently, Boston is a seven seed, and the sixth seed is actually Chicago. So it's kind of interesting to see who do you want to kind of play, because Heat are going to face the Bucks and dismantle them easily. But do you want to face Chicago, or do you want to face, you know, Boston? And that's where you kind of have to see if how do you jockey for that. Obviously, you can get home court in the first round. And then the Nets are right there as well, like the number four seed. So 2 through 7 is going to be very interesting. I think you have a little bit of a divide between the Knicks, the Pacers, and then the Nets. And there's a little bit of dip-off until, you know, beyond that. But as far as in the first round, you don't want to see Chicago. You don't want to really see Boston, for that matter. You'd probably be better off facing the Hawks in the first round or the Nets overall. So the East is looking like it's going to be very jam-packed from there. And then if you head off to the West, this is where you really start seeing an interesting divide as well. Spurs and Thunder continuing to battle for the number one seed in the West and overall. The 3 and 4 seeds, this is probably the most intriguing one, besides the 8 seed in the West, which I'll get to. Right now, the number 3 seed is, and 4 seeds, it's the same. Memphis and Denver have the same record. So that's your 3 and 4 seed. And then the Clippers are right down there at the number 5 seed. As far as who you want to kind of avoid in the, you kind of want to get in that 3 seed. Because the sixth seed right now is the Warriors, 7th seed Houston. And no disrespect to the Warriors and the Rockets. They've both been regular season surprises for various reasons. While both have offenses that can maybe get you for a game or so, I don't think that they're consistent enough to really upset you over a 7-game series. You really want to avoid that 4 or 5 game, because or 4 or 5 seed, because that's where you're looking at facing the Clippers. And that's a team with the best bench in the NBA and their overall production. You really want to be careful avoiding that. And then also you might have to deal with the Nuggets as well. Probably have the deepest team, 1 through 12, in the entire NBA as well. So a lot of interesting NBA thoughts there. And then finally getting to the 8th seed between Utah, the Lakers, and Dallas. I guess honestly, you're going to lose to San Antonio or the Thunder in the first round. Respect to the Jazz, though. They won 5 in a row. They look like they were going to be dead team walking there for a while. But they've gotten their act together. Lakers, I thought, would get a run together and really solidify themselves in the playoffs, but that hasn't happened. They're technically outside of the playoffs if it started today. And respect to the Mavericks as well. They've had a lot of injuries as well. Dirk Nowitzki has had an inconsistent season by his standards, but he's actually hung in there and kept that team afloat since he's come back, and getting good contributions from O.J. Mayo and Vince Carter and everything like that. I guess for the theatrical purposes, it'd be fun to see the Lakers, I guess, in the playoffs and see them implode on a national stage and just get trounced by the Spurs or Thunder. So those are the NBA thoughts there as far as what you're looking at. And as far as the other teams, they're fillers at this stage. I mean, it's tough watching a Detroit and Bobcats contest or seeing the 76ers face the Timberwolves. So right now we are right in the middle of the playoff push, and in a few weeks it's going to really get going, and I'm really excited about that. So we're going to take a break here, last break of the show, I promise. And when I come back, I'm going to hit some miscellaneous news and notes from the world of sports there. And then we're going to finally get to the my ruffling the feathers section on injuries and how they are broadcasted on television and even on Twitter here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. It was a light weekend in the world of auto racing. Easter weekend is always a time where you see different organizations not even race over that weekend, or they have maybe some early races to avoid the Easter weekend, and so there's not going to be much in the auto racing front. However, I did watch a lot of NCAA action as far as the other sports. I got roped into watching some college hockey this weekend. They had their version of the, they don't really have a Sweet 16 necessarily. They just have regions where they just pick the best 16 teams, four regions. Winner of that heads to the Frozen Four. Now, I must admit that I watch a lot of NHL hockey, and we're going to have a nice review of NHL action on the next podcast. So you look forward to that, all of my puck heads out there. But when I think of college hockey, I usually think of some elite, well, not elite, but more well-known programs, like a Boston College, the defending national champions from last season, North Dakota, Michigan, maybe Ohio State, some Michigan State, and Boston University, maybe even New Hampshire, and teams in the New England area. And most recently, Miami of Ohio and Denver has made a nice run, and Notre Dame have had some good moments on the college front. I didn't see really too many of those teams winning this past weekend. It's going to be interesting, Frozen Four. Yale actually got a big win, and they're making the Frozen Four. It's going to be their first appearance since 1952. And then, honestly, three teams that I have not even thought of having college programs or even knowing of are making their first appearances. We have St. Cloud State out of Minnesota. I've been told by my Minnesota friends that if I do pick a team, it's supposed to be Minnesota as far as who I like. I know Lake Superior State is the one I'm supposed to avoid. I'm supposed to not like them. St. Cloud State, I really don't know what my opinion is of that. I need to talk to my Minnesota buddies and see if I should be supporting them. But they're making their first appearance. UMass Lowell, I didn't even know that school existed. So respect to them for making the Frozen Four. And then Quinnipiac, who honestly, they're in the state of New York where I'm from. Unfamiliar with their existence until the middle of this season. And I actually found out about them because I was watching NBC Sports Network a few weeks ago, and they were the number one team in the nation. And I was like, I've never heard of them before. So I did some research. They're in upstate New York. Interesting squad. I don't know how it's going to be received having them in the Frozen Four in Pittsburgh. I know with other sports, and even down here in Atlanta with the Final Four for men's basketball, you kind of find yourself rooting for, it's an interesting mix. You like seeing the Cinderella stories or the unknown team or lesser known teams make a run, but you also want to see some of the traditional powers. And that's where, you know, going back to the regions, you kind of wanted to see maybe Ohio State get in over Wichita State. maybe you want to see Duke over Louisville, or maybe if you want to see Florida, if you're a Southeastern team in this area, maybe over a Michigan. So, I mean, those are not my opinions, but I mean, I've heard that from other people. Personally, I like seeing new teams have opportunities. And how are you going to build up new teams or get interest in these different pockets without getting these different squads in there? Now, Minnesota has a strong following as far as hockey, so it could have been any of those Minnesota squads. Like Minnesota State could even made it there, so Minnesota fans are going to follow. But Quinnipiac, I'm going to go for them because they're a New York team. I'm not too familiar with a lot of New York college ice hockey teams, so I'm going to be pulling for them a little bit because they're in there. And then UMass Lowell, obviously New England's strong representation, and as Yale as well, as far as some Ivy League hockey. But I think it's really good when you get some different squads in there and get some interest from other teams or other fan bases. And then the women's basketball side, it was a great weekend for Louisville. They beat the women's basketball team, beat Baylor and Brittany Griner in the Sweet 16. Now, this one is an interesting one as well as far as women's basketball side. Basketball, more than any other sport, is star-driven. And to have the most known player, maybe in history of the game, and I can argue that Brittany Griner's the most famous and known player ever in women's basketball. I'm not saying she's the best. That's another argument for another day. But, I mean, for all the great players, from Cheryl Miller to Shamika Holzclaw, Sue Bird, Maya Moore more recently, and you go down a list of all of the elite talents over the years, I think with this age of the internet and with Twitter, and obviously Griner's basketball skills as a post player, she's more famous, I think, on a mainstream level than all those other players were. And this was the last chance that the NCAA would see her, you know, playing on this stage. She's going to move on to WNBA and play internationally with the Team USA and the Olympics and everything like that. But I'm pretty sure that the women's game, while you're happy to see Louisville, I guess, get the win, you're more disappointed that Griner's not on a national stage to bring more attention to the game of women's college basketball. So interesting seeing them lose in that contest, and I guess UConn and California are now in the Final Four, and two more spots will be decided tonight. So caught up on some NCAA college sports besides basketball. Springtime is always my favorite time of year. I like springtime more than the fall because we got baseball, and we'll get some more baseball when the College World Series pops around, and we got basketball, and I like the college hockey is ending now, and we're going to get some lacrosse action as well. So this is my favorite time of year on the college sports side. So besides watching all of the NCAA men's basketball tournament stuff, I also caught up on some other sports. So now we're going to get to what ruffled my feathers over the weekend, and it was the Kevin Ware injury and how it was broadcast and addressed by the internet and the media. The biggest story over the weekend, despite everything that I've talked about, was actually not who won or lost the contest. It was who was injured and the merging of the internet and broadcasting with the respectfulness of a player going through probably the worst injury of his career. And what I'm speaking of is Kevin Ware, the Louisville player, who in the middle of the first half in the regional final against Duke suffered a gruesome and devastating broken leg near the Louisville bench. Now, I actually watched this contest live while it was taking place, and when he jumped up to block the three-point shot attempt by the Duke player and landed on his leg, I saw him go down and I thought, wow, he must have really sprained something severely, or he tore a knee ligament or something along those lines. And I think we've become desensitized to those things where it's basketball, it's part of the game, tears happen. We all know someone that suffered a torn knee ligament or something of that form while playing basketball. What we weren't expecting is the visual of the broken leg emerging from the skin near the bench and all of his teammates and their emotional reactions to it. I personally thought that maybe when I saw the players on the court crying on the ground or very emotional, I thought that was maybe an accident of maybe bumping heads or something like that. I thought that the CBS handled it properly. You saw the play, they showed the replay, you saw the leg buckle, and you had to show the replay to show what happened to him. Hey, that's just a part of broadcasting. They showed the leg buckle, you can assume that something was not right with what happened, and from there, they showed the reaction of the players. Rick Pitino, obviously very emotional, the head coach of Louisville, he was fighting back tears. And I don't know what more you can do as far as the broadcast. I've seen people say, oh, they showed a replay that was disrespectful. Unfortunately, it is a part of sports that injuries happen. We're not used to seeing that severe of an injury visually on the basketball court. But maybe it's a desensitization of me from watching mixed martial arts on a regular basis, as well as soccer and seeing even rugby matches where I've seen the broken legs happen. And while it's not something I wish upon a player on any level, you never wish that, I've seen the injuries and it did not turn my stomach or it did not make me feel nauseous or negative about it. Turning over to the media side of it and the Twitter side of it, it was an interesting fascination with that, where you had people who were appalled that people saw the injury or wanted to see more of the injury and get more information on it. My personal side of things are, if you wanted to see the leg break and you wanted to see the digital gifs of it or the replay of it, it's out there. And I saw the pictures and saw everything that happened. But if you're going to make critical analysis of the portrayal of injuries in the media, you need to look at every sport. We've seen the Joe Theismann injury hundreds of times. If you're a sports fan, that gets replayed over and over again, and no one bats an eye at it. We've seen broken arms in mixed martial arts. Baseball, we've seen guys get hit in the leg and breaking their ankles, and no one bats an eye at that. I don't understand where you have a media outlet doing their job, like CBS or even some other print journalism or online sites, doing their job and showing the replay and showing the picture, and that's being bad journalism. It was a part of the game. And honestly, I think that we're getting the desensitization needs to happen more quickly in sports. And I said, maybe it's the combat sport fan in me, but injuries happen. Every time you step out on any court or any field, no matter what the sport is, you risk the injury. And while I feel bad for Kevin Ware, and while this will set his career back, he knew what he was getting into when he was playing the sport. And they all know what they're getting into. So while I feel the pain, not literally, and I do feel it figuratively, I guess, for that player, he understands the risks that are out there. That's why I have not no sympathy, but I have not too much sympathy for athletes that go out there and play and get injured. Injuries happen. While it was something that we're not used to seeing on a basketball court, it happens on every walk of life. If you really want to break it down, while Kevin Ware is getting all this love and sympathy, and deservedly so, hopefully his career gets back on track, there's soldiers dying every day out in the world protecting our countries and others. There are people who suffer way more issues and injuries, whether it's cancer, or debilitating illnesses that they won't be able to fight back from and not have resources that a Mr. Ware is going to have. So in the end, we need more perspective on how we cover injuries in sports and realize it is a part of the game and a part of life. Thank you once again for listening to another edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast. This has been E. Marcel Portu. Once again, we'll have this podcast up very soon. You always head to iTunes and subscribe to us under the Sports Inquirer, and you'll get the shows there. You can also go to our website, thesportsinquirer.net, where there'll be news and notes continually on the world of sports. And finally, on Twitter, just look up Sports Inquirer, and I have some information constantly updated on there. Once again, next show will probably be recorded on Wednesday or Thursday. So whenever that's up, I will put it on, and we will continue our journey through the world of sports. Until then, everybody, good day, good night.